Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to talk about the delegates in Germany this week haggling over details of the Paris Climate Accord. What's next now that the U.S. plans to pull out? But first, it's textbook changing time again. We've all grown up with the idea that the first people to arrive in North America traveled over that land bridge across the Bering Strait, right? Connecting Asia to what is now North America. But over the years, archaeologists have investigated other theories. And after several decades of mounting evidence, scientists have concluded that that land bridge was not the earliest route taken. It was, in fact, the Kelp Highway. That was the earliest route. Here to fill in the details of that story and other short subjects in science is Annalee Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. Welcome back, Annalee.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us what this Kelp Highway was.
So the Kelp Highway is a term for the route that people took along the coast from northern Asia up along Russia, what's now Russia, and through, you know, along the Bering Strait and then down Alaska and into the United States. And it's called the Kelp Highway because there was a rich ecosystem along the coast where these peoples who actually had terrific boat technology, they had these reed boats that allowed them to just hug the coast. They weren't, you know, going over open water. And the kelp forests along the coast would have been a rich source of food for them. So there's a great explanation here for why people would have taken that route, because all this kelp along the coast would attract fish and other animals that they could hunt. So those boats were not just a way for them to transit to the States, but also to hunt.
So what kind of new evidence? Well, what's happening right now that we're getting to see? Settlements previously buried underwater that's convinced scientists?
Yeah, it's a super interesting set of discoveries. So really, since the 1980s, there have been a lot of questions about this Bering land bridge idea, because you really couldn't have crossed from the Bering land bridge into North America until about 12 or 13,000 years ago, because there were just huge glaciers blocking the way. So what scientists started to notice was that there were these campsites all the way down as far as Argentina that may be about 17,000 years old. And some scientists believe they're even older than that. So a lot of the problem with finding this evidence is that although some of these campsites are inland, usually along rivers that have come up from the ocean, from the coast, is that a lot of the campsites that people created as they took the kelp highway are now underwater because water levels have risen. The ice age is over, you might have noticed.
Yeah.
And water levels have risen. And so now there's new techniques for investigating these underwater campsites. Everything from remote vehicles to underwater lasers are allowing archaeologists to dive down underwater and investigate.
Oh. So the consensus has changed. It used to be one if by land, now it's two if by sea. So to speak.
And people did come by land. It's just that they were the ones who came second. So yeah, they would have arrived in the Americas with people already here.
That's very, very interesting. Let's move on to a group of archaeologists who have been excavating a site in Russia, and they found something really weird. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is the kind of archaeology mystery that may haunt your dreams, especially if you like dogs. So I apologize for that.
Don't set it up like that.
So this is a site that archaeologists have been investigating since the late 1990s. Right. And they finally pulled together enough evidence to talk about this one settlement that they found. It's in the northern steppes of Russia, where they came upon this ancient structure that's it's from the late Bronze Age, so it's about 4,000 years old. And inside was a pit with the remains of 67 dogs who had been ritualistically sacrificed over a period of about 100 years, and always in the winter. Hmm. So they knew that this was something that was a kind of annual or semi-annual ritual. And what people had done was they'd sacrificed the dogs, they'd cut them up very ritualistically, and then cooked and eaten them. And this is not an area where, at that time, people would have been eating dogs regularly. So this was a kind of inversion mm-hmm. of their normal eating activities. And that's always, for archaeologists, any kind of inversion like that is always a sign of a ritual, because rituals are times when we do things very differently than the ordinary. So their big question was, what the heck were people doing? Why were they ritualistically sacrificing them? Why were they eating them? So the answer comes from mythology. And they, of course, we can't be certain without a time machine, but it looks as if what this was an Indo-European cultural rite of passage. Indo-European culture was common throughout Europe and South Asia at the time. And many of these cultures had a ritual where boys became hunters and warriors by symbolically turning into dogs and wolves. And eating these dogs would have been part of that ritual, taking the dog or the wolf into themselves and becoming warriors. And these dogs were very well cared for. They were older dogs, so they were probably beloved dogs. So it would have been a very emotional thing to sacrifice them and to take them in.
Yeah. As someone with four grand dogs, I understand that. So that's good.
Yeah. The other great thing about this... Yeah, it is interesting. The other great thing about the story that I'll add really quickly is that it's also thought, some scholars believe that these rituals are connected to the myth of the werewolf. So we might actually be witnessing a kind of werewolf ritual taking place here.
Yeah, I knew you'd weave Game of Thrones in here somehow. Finally, there's good news for journalists, evidence that small news organizations can influence public opinion as much as large newsrooms.
That's right. A group of scholars at Harvard did a very long-term study where they looked at small media organizations, basically the opposite of the mainstream media, and found that if three or more of those organizations wrote about the same policy topic that day, whether the topic was water or immigration or climate, they had a broad range of topics. If three or more of them covered that topic, discussion of that topic would rise by 62% on Twitter in the following week.
Wow.
So it was really affecting our public conversations. And I talked to one of the researchers, Ariel White, who's a political scientist at MIT, and she said if they'd done this study 100 years ago, they would have gone into public squares and listened to people yelling on soapboxes. And so they treated Twitter kind of like the soapbox of our time, and that's why they chose to measure influence in that area. But it means that the non-mainstream media has a huge impact, and it's not just the mainstream media that's guiding the conversation.
Fascinating. Thank you, Annalie.
Thanks for having me.
Annalie Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. It's 9. Now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KQED Iowa News. Public Radio News.
This is when we take a closer look at science in the states. And today in Florida, where the Florida Panther is iconic enough to be an NHL team, but the cat species itself is endangered. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission estimates there are only a couple of hundred adult panthers in the wild, but how best to monitor them? Craig Pittman, staff writer at the Tampa Bay Times, has the details. There's a link to his article on our website. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
So let's talk about this. For those of us not familiar, describe a Florida panther for us.
They're, you know, part of the puma species we see in different places around the country that once, you know, roamed widely across our wilderness areas. And as the wilderness diminished, so did their habitat and their population. But they are the only recognized puma species east of the Mississippi that's left. And they're kind of mostly all pushed down into the southern tip of the state, down where the Everglades and Big Cypress National Preserve are located. And at one point, there were only about 20 of them left in 1995. And thanks to diligent efforts. They now have about 200, still classified as endangered, obviously, but doing somewhat better than they used to be.
So I guess we need to track them because we really don't know where they go and live and hang out?
When they were first added to the endangered species list, when the first endangered species list came out, there were some state officials that were convinced it was all moot because they thought they were extinct already. And so the World Wildlife Fund actually hired a Texas tracker named Roy McBride, who's sort of legendary in those circles, to come down to Florida and find out if there were still panthers. And Roy managed to track one down, just sort of spindly old female, and to prove that panthers still existed. And he found panther signs through the rest of the landscape. So in 1981, the guy who was put in charge of the Florida Panther Program for the state, a guy named Chris Belden, he got permission very reluctant permission, I should add, to go out with Roy and Roy's dogs and track down a couple of panthers and put radio collars on them so they could find out where the panthers go, where they like to live, you know, that kind of thing. It was just your basic science. And it was apparently a pretty adventurous trip for them out there because they tracked down a panther, they shot it with a tranquilizer dart up in a tree, and then it didn't come down. Didn't come down out of the tree, so Belden actually had to climb the tree to try to bring the panther down, and they both fell out of the tree at the same time.
comes with the job.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So why do you want to stop it now? I mean, what's the problem? What's the issue?
It's not the problem. You know, and they've been doing this radio collar thing. You know, chasing the panthers with the dogs, tranquilizing them, and putting the radio collars on them ever since 1981. So 36 years. That's you know, I think the longest science project in Florida, but. They say that now they have better techniques for learning about panther life and that kind of thing, that the capture and collar program yielded some tremendous information, but now they have better ways. For instance, trap cameras, where the cameras are put out in places where they know the panthers are, and they are motion sensitive. So when a panther passes by, they get pictures of it. That was the way they found out that they had finally had a female panther cross over the Caloosahatchee River and show up more in the central Florida area for the first time.
Well, of course, if you just take a picture of one, you can't examine them, right, and see what their health is.
No, and that's the objection. One biologist I talked to, a woman named Deborah Jansen, who was along on that 1981 trip and has been studying with panthers ever since for the National Park Service in Big Cypress, she contends that there's still a value to continuing to do these capturing and collar things, because you examine the panthers, you learn about their medical condition. If there's a potential for an epidemic, they almost had an epidemic of feline leukemia at one point, then you can, you know, deal with that with inoculations and so forth. But the guy who's in charge of the program, Daryl Land, who's the panther team leader for the Wildlife Commission, he said, you know, it's very stressful for the cats. And he gave me this great quote. He said that they would probably prefer not to be chased up a tree by dogs, shot in the butt, go into a drug-induced coma, fall out of a tree, and wake up with bling.
All right, we've got to leave it at that, Craig. Thank you very much, Craig Pittman of Tampa Bay Times. We'll be right back after this break.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. With or without the United States, the work on the Paris Climate Accord continues. This week, talks are underway in Bonn, Germany, to nail down more details about how nations will meet their goals for cutting carbon emissions and how they will hold each other accountable in coming years. And just Tuesday, Syria signed on to the accord, leaving the U.S. as the only country not in agreement about climate change. Yet at the same time, the White House released a report just last week that highlighted human influence in climate change and warned the globe is already warming faster and more dramatically than previously predicted. This is the very same White House that is dismantling President Obama's initiatives to reduce U.S. carbon emissions. So what does all of this mean? What happens next? That's what we're going to be talking about. Our number 844-724-8255. Let me introduce my guests. Catherine Hayhoe, professor of political science and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. She was a lead author on the new U.S. government report. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Manyana Milkowright, assistant professor of political science at Purdue University. She has been at the talks in Bonn this week. Welcome to you, Dr. Milkowright.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for being on the show.
Perhaps you can fill us in. What's been happening at the talks this week? Can you give us a little wrap-up?
Sure. Happy to do that. So the talks have started, as you mentioned, working diligently on a lot of details to work out how the Paris Agreement can actually be implemented. Like any new agreement, the Paris Agreement has left a number of questions open and has raised a number of questions, especially with regard to implementing this new deal. And so parties are meeting to work out those details, which are really important to actually make it effective and make it work. Mm-hmm. So that's what they've been doing. This is not very exciting work. It's the nitty-gritty of putting in place rules and details that which parties call the Paris Rulebook. And that rulebook is supposed to be finished next year in 2018 at COP24 in Poland. So that's what they've been doing.
Uh-huh. And, of course, we've heard that Syria is in the accord, but the U.S. is pulling out, though they still have people in Bonn this week. Is that sort of a contradiction or not?
You might think that's a contradiction, but actually, for the time being, the U.S. is still a full member of the Paris Agreement. The agreement does not permit anybody to drop out for about 3 years after it comes into effect. That means until 2019, the U.S. is a full member and therefore has a very good reason to be here. Even after that, they would have a good reason to be at the negotiations because they're still a member of the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change. So the Paris Agreement is a component of that, a subcomponent, and they would be, even if they dropped out of that, they would still be part of this larger framework convention and therefore should be here to have a voice, and so that's what they're doing right now. But obviously, it is a bit contradictory if President Trump announces that he is not intending to stay in this agreement in the long run, but then negotiators are here and they are actively participating in working out the details of the Paris rulebook, which presumably will not apply to the U.S. So the negotiators are involved in making rules that will not apply to themselves if things go as President Trump intends them to go right now. So that, of course, has raised a few eyebrows and might make things complicated also in terms of the credibility maybe of the negotiators around the table. But at the same time, it is also true that other countries might be very interested in making this agreement work for the U.S., with a long-term view, but also in case anything might change over the next 3 years and might change President Trump's mind. So there are a number of angles to take to this, but yes, it is certainly a challenging situation for the U.S. delegation.
A lot of moving parts, like to say.
Absolutely.
Dr. Hayhoe, you're the lead author of this new U.S. report. What makes this scientifically important that we haven't heard from previous reports?
Well, the hundreds of pages in this report can really be summarized in one sentence. Climate is changing, humans are responsible, the risks are serious, and the window of time to keep global temperature below the level stated in the Paris Agreement is closing fast. Yet at the same time, this report also lays out in great detail a lot of new understanding and new research on how our choices, the choices we make on how we get our energy, whether we get it from coal or gas or oil or wind and solar, how our choices are affecting our planet, what it means to the oceans, to the Antarctic, to the giant ice sheets there, what's happening up in the Arctic, what's actually happening in the places where we live, how climate change is affecting the risk of some of the extreme events that we have seen so many of this year.
It almost seems contradictory. I mean, we're talking, that Dr. Milkowright about what's going on in Bonn, and now we have a report that's released by the administration that's contradicts the president's opinion about global warming being man-made or human-caused. Did this leak out by accident? without the White House's...
Ira, the irony is unescapable. At this point, the Climate Science Special Report, which people can find online at science2017.globalchange.gov, this report is currently the most comprehensive and up-to-date report on climate science in the entire world. And yes, it was released by the United States, the only country who has stated it will be pulling out of the Paris Agreement right before the Bonn meetings. What is going on? The reality is that this report had been in the pipeline for a very long time, almost 2 years. Public review drafts were already released last Christmas. The fifth order draft had been leaked to the New York Times in the summer, and I don't know for sure. I'm just an author. I'm not privy to the negotiations, but my educated guess would be that somebody realized that there would be 100 times more press and coverage if it were suppressed at this point than if it were just released. And that is a sad commentary on the state of our media today.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to get in on this discussion that is, I guess, bewildering on many different levels.
All right, maybe I could just add to that.
Please.
So I think the report was, you say it was released, and maybe it was simply not held back for smart reasons of letting the science be science. And certainly it's not the case that the U.S. delegation here is now stating any doubts about the climate science either, right? So they do not come here with any marching directions that entail climate skepticism of any kind. They are working constructively, and so in that sense, they're kind of two separate processes. Like, it is often the case that the science and the politics are rather separate, even if you expect them to merge and make sense of this problem together.
I hear you almost saying that people are just ignoring what the president has said, and doing business as usual.
No, certainly not. I mean, they do have a negotiation mandate that has come down partly, I believe, from the White House and from the leadership of the State Department. And as long as there are no contradictory policy directions from the White House, they will keep working on the climate problems within the UN National Policy as they have before, and that's what they do right now. And I think that, for now, this has not changed, and unforeseeable how it will change in the future.
Interesting. Well, let me ask you, with the stated intention of pulling out by 2020, will the U.S. pullout affect the success of the rest of the accord, Dr. Mulcahy?
So that is a very interesting question, and lots of people have been really worried about that. But it turns out, at least so far, that does not seem to be the case, at least not as badly as people have been concerned about. So one effect people have raised is that other countries might follow suit, given that the U.S. is the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. Them pulling out might actually signal to others that they should do the same, or they might weaken the accord. Even if they don't do it explicitly, they might do it silently by simply not upholding their own promises and not taking action as they have promised to do so far, and not increasing the action either, because it is a collective action problem. If not everybody pulls their weight, we cannot solve this problem. And so that has been a concern, but all countries have restated their commitment to the deal. They are here, they're working constructively, and they're repeating their intention to increase ambition over time, which is a challenging thing to do and has been going very slow. But nevertheless, there has been no pulling back, at least no explicit pulling back from others. However, the challenge is, of course, that the U.S. is a big emitter, and in the long run, without U.S. contributions, the agreement will not be as effective as it could be if they were in. So that really is something where, in the long run, there will have to be an American contribution to solve the climate challenge.
And if I may add, the discussion so far suggests that there is not an American contribution, and that is actually completely false. It's not a 0 or 100%. As we currently stand, states, cities, businesses, and other organizations representing 40% of the U.S. population and $6 trillion of the U.S. economy are committed to the We Are Still In movement. The United States does not have a pavilion in Bonn, but the We Are Still In movement does have a pavilion led by Michael Bloomberg and Jerry Brown. So we are looking at a large fraction, not quite half, but still a large fraction of the United States, which includes 9 states, 252 cities, and almost 1,800 businesses and investors are still in on the Paris Agreement.
All right, let me check in on another story about climate, and this has to do with weather satellites. NOAA is launching one today to observe the poles, and this is the first in its new Joint Polar Satellite System series. But while our existing fleet of polar satellites is indeed aging and suffering, the new ones may not be enough to keep track of one very important piece of climate data, and that is the polar ice coverage. Here to explain more is David Gallagher, Senior Associate Scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder. Welcome, David, to Science Friday.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good.
Little weak, but we can hear you. Tell us why this, where does our data about polar ice coverage come from?
Currently, and for the last, since 1979, our standard basis for ice, sea ice in particular, has come from a series of satellites called the DMSP series. This is the Defense Military Satellite Program that's been in existence since 1963. The passive microwave record starts in 1979, the continuous record, that is, starts in 79, and it's the ability of a passive microwave to see through the clouds that gives us a steady, coherent mechanism saying, okay, this is not only here's where the ice is and where it isn't, but also a way to compare from year to year. Is it growing? Is it shrinking? It's that long-term record, that time series record that enables us to really get this and get a handle on it.
Mm-hmm. And why won't the satellite launching today do the job?
It'll help, but it's not complete. Unfortunately, it's missing some of the lowermost frequencies that we use in establishing where that ice is.
Why isn't there a better replacement ready to go then?
There was. This is where it gets interesting. There was a satellite called F-20 that was already bought and paid for. We're talking a satellite that was worth around $400 million in today's dollars. It was built almost 20 years ago, but the Air Force had bought these in a block called DMSP. It was their Block 3C.
Whatever.
Anyway, they had bought this whole series. Anyway, they decided Congress defunded the last satellite, and it was subsequently destroyed last year. They actually were forced to take it apart.
Well, let me give this. Let me give the break idea to talk about. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Right.
Talking now with David Gallagher. They were forced to destroy the satellite.
Yes, Congress defunded the satellite. They said, nope, you can't launch it. And they're going, wait a minute, guys, it's only, we've already paid for this thing. It's sitting there ready to go. The Obama administration was for it. The Air Force was for it. The Congress said, nope, we're not giving any money. And they wouldn't even allow them to keep it in storage. They said the storage cost at $40 million a year was excessive. Its cost over the 20 years of the program has cost too much, and get rid of the satellite. So guess what they're doing now? They're trying now to put in money to build another satellite.
You know,
the problem is that they're not going to get that new satellite built, and our old satellites are starting to fail.
Wow.
These were only designed to last 5 years, and the newest one of which is already 7 years old.
You know,
are we going to last another 6 years? That's the question.
Well, why don't they just, as one congressman once told Jane Lubchenco, why don't you just turn to the Weather Channel and use their satellite, you know?
Yeah, I know. I always love that, don't you? Where do you think the Weather Channel gets their data? last I checked, they don't have any satellites. So
there's going to be a gap in the data then, you're saying?
Right, and this is highly significant because it's kind of the best analogy I can put is imagine you're a long-term heart patient who's not doing well, kind of like Earth. You're wearing a full-time heart monitor to see what's going on. Suddenly they say, oh, we're going to have to take that heart monitor away. And where there's a new one, it's on order, but it won't be here for another few months. And then they get the new one in. Oh, these leads are all different. We're not getting the same data. Well, how do you compare the old to the new? And the answer is you can't.
Wow.
And that's what we're up against. If we get a gap, we won't, even if they get a new satellite up, we won't be able to really compare those two records if there's not an overlap.
Dr. Hayhoe, any reaction?
Yes, this is, the idea that a stitch in time saves nine later on. We're looking at a lot more than nine stitches in terms of building a new satellite. And I think this is the kind of endemic disregard of science, of observing not just science, but observing what is happening to this planet. Somehow, we as humans have ended up with this idea that we don't need our planet. We would be just fine floating in outer space. The reality is we depend on this planet for the air we breathe every second, the food we eat, the water we drink, the places where we live. It is our home, and understanding what is happening to our home and what we are doing to our home should be essential, and it should just be common sense.
And this is the record that NSIDC and actually the rest of the world then uses to really say, how are we doing?
Yeah, let me see if I can get a quick call in before the break. Let's go to Jim in Cypress Heights, California. Hi, Jim. Jim.
Good morning.
Quickly.
Good afternoon for you. Hello.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm running out of time before the break.
My question is, why do you always focus on the politics of climate change? I have many friends who are skeptics. And you never actually talk about the science.
We talk about the science all the time.
I'd love to take that one.
Quickly.
All right. It's because 99.9% of the time, the reason why people object to climate change is not really because of the science. Sure, they throw up sciencey sounding arguments like it's just a natural cycle, and we tackle that in our PBS Global Weirding videos that you can find on YouTube. But if you have a conversation within 3 minutes with somebody who doesn't think the science is real, within 3 minutes or less, it will pivot to, I don't want the government telling me what to do, or Al Gore, yada, 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 or, you know, they're going to take my truck away. The real problem is the ideology, is the politics, the solutions.
We're going to say goodbye to David Gallagher, a senior associate scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder. The rest of you, stay on the line, keep calling us, and we'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking about the future of the Paris Climate Accord as international talks continue in Bonn this week. We're talking with Catherine Hayhoe, professor of political science, director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech. That's in Lubbock, Texas. And Manyanya Milkowright, who is assistant professor of political science at Purdue University. She's been at the talks in Bonn this week. So in the few minutes we have left, I know, Dr. Hayhoe, you were eager to jump on that call about not believing in this. And is there anything you can say to people who are climate skeptics or deniers that would change anybody's mind?
So it isn't a black or white issue. It isn't a yes or no. If we look across the spectrum, only 10% of the population are hardcore dismissives, in that they will dismiss anything, any piece of evidence you show them. Many more people are doubtful or even cautious about this. Why are they doubtful and cautious? Because they're hearing people say contradictory things, and they're being told that who they are, if they are a conservative, if they are a person of faith, if they are a Republican, if they believe in the free market or national security, they're being told that who they are is a person who can't support the solutions, because the only solutions are the government setting your thermostat, taking away your truck, ruining the economy, and letting China rule the world. These are kind of the fake solutions that are presented. So how do we get around this? By talking the real solutions, by talking about how wind supplies, 15% of Texas's electricity almost by now, by the fact that Chinese companies are coming into Wyoming and training coal miners who've lost their jobs on how to do wind installations, by the fact that we are seeing changes all around the world happening. India is setting the cheapest prices in solar energy this past year. We're seeing the solutions, and they're solutions that grow the local economy and invest in people at the local scale. They're not solutions that are punitive, that would destroy the economy, and that would run counter to people's political ideology.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Milkowright, the Paris Accord ultimately does not force any country to lower its carbon emissions. Do you think this kind of agreement can be successful then in slowing warming anyway?
That is something that remains to be seen. So as you said, everybody only has voluntary commitments. Every country makes pledges, and so it's plans and that they want to fulfill, or at least state that they're going to fulfill over the next few years. And the way the Paris Agreement is trying to deal with the question of effectiveness and trying to make sure that these pledges actually all add up to reaching the globally shared temperature goal, for example, is by setting up a number of transparency and review mechanisms the so-called ambition cycle in negotiation jargon. And that means that not only do countries make new pledges or revise pledges every 5 years, but they also check in on each other's pledges and actions every 5 years to track and assess how far they have gotten. So there are a number of mechanisms that try to look at what countries have actually done and how much it adds up to in terms of moving towards these triad goals. And parties hope that this collective process of assessment and transparency, creating some kind of peer pressure and a bit of a psychological moment of truth every 5 years, is going to help nudge parties to keep doing more over time. So it's an architecture that is constantly trying to create momentum towards more action on climate change. And it remains to be seen if that's going to work, but those are the kinds of details that are being worked out in Bonn right now. And if they're being worked out in a good way, then we might see some success over the next 5, 10, 15 years with a regular stock-taking and transparency mechanism.
So what would be the best-case scenario, then, that could come out of the accord?
Well, the best-case scenario is that this cycle of ambition actually works. So currently, as you probably know, countries have pledged or have made their initial pledges with the Paris Accord in 2015, and those pledges do not get us anywhere close to the global temperature goal of well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. They get us about one-third there, which means everybody's got to do more. If the rules parties put in place end up working and actually encouraging every party to make revised pledges every 5 years that go up over time, so there's an implicit norm here that countries would make pledges that go up or increase their ambition, right? They would pledge more over time. And that the more one party pledges, the more another party might be encouraged to pledge, and also the more the wealthy parties actually do to support the developing countries, the more the developing countries can contribute to this process too. So the theory is that over time, these promises would add up to more, and the ratchet mechanism, as it's called, would work its way towards closing the emissions gap, and now also an adaptation and a finance gap that people are talking about.
Dr. Hayhoe, do you agree this is best outcome?
Yes.
You could expect.
I do. When in Paris, most of us were thinking about all the carbon emission reductions that developed countries had to do, but many more countries were there saying, hey, we haven't hardly produced any carbon emissions at all. Yet we need to not only develop, not only build our economies, but we are increasingly coping with the impacts of a changing climate, a climate that's changing not because of anything that we really did. So to me, the best analogy for this international process is a potluck dinner. Who's bringing what to the table? The people who've contributed the most to the hunger problem need to show up with the biggest dishes. And as you know from potlucks, you know, you always end up with too much of one thing and not enough of another.
Spoken like a true Texan. Thank you very much, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, and Manyanya Milkerite, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Purdue University. She was at the talks in Bonn this week. You're probably set out in a field somewhere, and a buzzing bumblebee or a honeybee might catch your eye. You watch it carefully. It hovers and inspects each flower, and then it takes off mid-flight onto the next flower. You know, these are fascinating things to watch, but what you may not have noticed are the smaller cousins of these bees. Some are no bigger than a grain of rice, and they're just as fascinating as their charismatic cousins, like the bee that drinks the sweat and tears of animals. Did you know about that one? And then there's the carpenter bee, the smaller carpenter bee, the hairy belly bee. The list goes on. There are thousands of these tiny bees, and they also play a big role in pollination. My next guest studies how that works. She's an author on a study out this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. She's going to take us into the world of these tiny bees. Charlene Jha is an associate professor of integrative biology at the University of Texas in Austin. Texas Day on Science Friday. Welcome. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Syra.
When you think of bees, you know, you imagine a colony of bees, but I understand that most of these smaller wild bees, they're loners?
That's right. About 90% of all bees are actually solitary. So despite kind of the public impression that all bees are like honeybees and bumblebees, we have a lot of these bees that are living on their own.
So where do they live?
So most bees live underground, so they nest under the soil. We also have a lot of bees that nest in stems of trees or in rotting logs. So there's a lot of diversity in where these bees live and also the kind of social versus solitary lifestyle they maintain.
Tell me about something called bee bread.
So bee bread is this mixture of honey and pollen and some other secretions that solitary bees create for their offspring, for their babies. And they create this little ball of resources, and then they'll lay their eggs on top of this ball of food. And the exciting thing about this is that there's a lot of species interactions going on. There's actually fungus and bacteria in that bread that adds to the nutritive value of that bread. And so they lay their eggs, and then that egg will hatch into a larvae. And as it grows, it'll consume that food. Mm. And so bees provide this care for their offspring in the form of this bread.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about bees. This is fascinating because I'm sure most of us don't even know that these bees are out there. Let's talk about some of the more fascinating ones. The sweat bee, does it really drink our tears? Do we know what's happening?
It does, actually. So it got its nickname because humans noticed it drinking their own perspiration and also the fluids of other animals. There are some great photos in National Geographic showing butterflies and bees drinking the tears of alligators and turtles. And what we believe is going on is they're trying to get a limited resource. So things like sodium and other micronutrients can be limiting for these bees, and so they need to get them somewhere, and tears or sweat are often good places.
You know, I've seen the big carpenter bees around the house. They're always drilling holes I can stick my fingers in my mailbox post. What's the difference between these big ones and the tiny carpenter bees?
Yeah, so great question. So these bigger carpenter bees are nesting in, you know, large chunks of wood, and they both the big ones and these little tiny carpenter bees called, you know, the Serotina bees, they tend to nest in little stems of trees, but they're both really fascinating, and they're actually pretty closely related, and they often go back to their old nest sites and kind of refurbish the homes where they were born, so where their mothers actually laid them. And so they have this high level, we believe, high level of kind of fidelity to these woody materials in which they were born.
And I know you recently published a study that you did in Panama that looked at the role these rice-sized bees play in pollination. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, so in this study, we were investigating basically how these trees were engaging in sexual reproduction. And the way we did this was through a paternity analysis. And it's very similar to the way humans conduct paternity analysis. So you look at the DNA of an offspring or a child to figure out who the parents are. And we did the same thing with plants, where we looked at the DNA in a seed to figure out where pollen was coming from. And what this allowed us to do was create kind of a little roadmap of where pollinators had been traveling before they landed on a receptive flower. And this was important for us to understand because although, you know, most global crop species depend on animal pollination and most flowering plants in general depend on pollination, we actually knew very little about how they move. So what we found were these tiny bees were traveling more than a mile. It's basically a million times their body size in terms of distance. Mm. So, you know, to put it in human context, it would be like traveling from Chicago to L.A. Based on just the energy that you produced.
Wow. Our number 844-724-8255, talking about bees on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Let me go to the phones because, you know, people love to talk about bees. And let's go to Max in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Max.
Hey, Ira.
Hey there.
Max. Right now, I go to UW La Crosse. I'm a microbiome major, and I'm trying to isolate yeast from the guts of bees. And I was just curious how the gut microbiomes vary between the solitary bees and the bees that are commonly found in colonies.
Mm. Our favorite topic.
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. So work on the microbiomes of bees is actually something else that we do here at the University of Texas in Austin in Nancy Moran's lab. And we, you know, what we're seeing is that there's quite a lot of variation in microbiomes, and it depends very much on environmental drivers, histories of these bees, but very likely social interactions, because we know that colonies can engage in trophallaxis, so this exchange of fluids through their mouth parts can actually alter these microbiomes. But that's still, it's a research direction that we're moving in, and I think it's a really interesting and hot topic.
If these tiny bees don't live in hives, I know over the winter, the regular honeybee hives, they generate like over 90 degree temperature inside while it's freezing outside. How do these solitary bees stay alive?
That's a great question. So most solitary bees actually live for pretty short time periods, so just a few weeks at a time. So they're out foraging for food for their offspring, that next generation, and they carry out that work in oftentimes these very short periods where, you know, their floral resources or their flowers of interest are blooming. And so most of them don't survive the winter. They actually just live for that short summer, spring, late fall period, and then lay their eggs, and then the next generation emerges the following year.
Let me go to Linda in Sacramento. Quick question, Linda. Hi there, Linda. Are you there?
Linda,
yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm here. I'm just wondering if some of these bees that you're talking about, some of the solitary bees that nest underground, if they're subject to insect problems like the honeybees have, for example, varroa mite.
Good question. Yeah,
Absolutely. And you know, there's a lot of interesting research into parasites and pathogens, including varroa mites, including diseases like Nosema and Crithidia parasites. So there's lots of sort of potential threats to these wild solitary bees. The reality is we just know less about them because we've spent a bit more of our energy on honeybees and bumblebees. And so this is a new area of research which we're starting to investigate.
Can we see, I know you do your studying down in the tropics. Can we see these tiny bees everywhere up here, up northern latitudes?
Absolutely. So all over. So some of these small bees that we talked about a little earlier, like sweat bees, exist all over the world in terrestrial landscapes. So in plant communities where they provide pollination services, and in the tropics, we tend to have a lot of these what we call stingless bees. These are bees that are closely related to honeybees, but they're much smaller in size.
Wow.
And are really important for native plant reproduction as well.
Well, Dr. Jha, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. It was fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me,
Aaron. You're welcome. Shalini Jha, Associate Professor of Integrative Biology at the University of Texas in Austin. That's about the last. I'll run out of time, but before we go, one last thing. I am no mathematician, but I do know that if every one of our 2 million listeners gave $1 to SciFry, we would never have to ask you for money to support our programs again. $1, that's pretty crazy, right? Unfortunately, I know, we all know that's not going to happen. And things like microphones, electricity, salaries, thumb drives are not free. So if you like our show and you feel sorry for the poor staffer doing the fundraising math for 2018, please make a donation now. We are counting on you. Get it counting. Couldn't resist that. But seriously, folks, please make a donation at sciencefriday.com/give. sciencefriday.com/give. It's the holiday season. We're hoping you'll think about us, too. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Our radio intern is Sushmita Paddock, to whom we bid a fond farewell this week. She's going to be leaving us for a paying job, we hope, somewhere. Good paying job. Thank you very much, Sushmita. You've been a pleasure to have. We have technical help today from Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz. And, of course, we're all over, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media, and also Amazon Echo, Google Home. Every day is now Science Friday. Happy World Science Day. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.